during that meditation was so interesting. I just got to this place of like real kind of sublime stillness, and then the music started right there, and I just started wanting marching right along with it. It was really fun. Well, it feels like it's been a long time. It's great to be back. It's great to see you. And for those of you who are here for the first time, welcome. I wanted to say a little bit tonight about some of the practices that are kind of designed to cultivate our hearts, to cultivate qualities of compassion and kindness and love. It's been a number of weeks since I've been back, and one of the events, which I mentioned in the email, is while I was at the fall retreat, my beloved dog died. And one of the things I love about coming here to St. Mark's is the dogs. Well, I don't think we have any here tonight, but dogs are welcome, and it's just been so cool to have another species present when we're meditating. And my dog was just shy of 15 years old, and like all dogs, a wonderful dog. And I could go on all night about him, but I'll spare you that. But I came back from the retreat to be with him, and where it was very clear that he had to go. He had to move on. And one of the most powerful things for me in that experience, in just feeling kind of the dread and the letting go and the pain, was a realization that I'm not alone in that experience. You know, that we've all had an experience of letting go of something incredibly dear to us. And if we haven't, we will soon. There's something about the recognition that we all share in the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows that somehow makes it a little more bearable. The other thing I've noticed is that at least for me, that the emotion of grief comes in waves. Like most emotions, they kind of come in waves. You're sort of like going along fine, and there's a certain thought or some kind of stimulation, and then we start thinking about something that we've lost, and then we feel it. We just feel it as a wave of emotions. And oftentimes, waves they build as a pressure inside, and with that pressure, oftentimes is a sense that there's something wrong. You know, there's something either something wrong with me or something wrong externally. And with that tension, we start to react. And we go into classic reactive patterns. We either go into anger, judgment, blame, hatred, or we jump off that wave and we go into planning or fantasy or shifting our attention to something pleasant. Or we get taken away by anxiety and worry. Or we simply numb out. We lose connection with it and we find ourselves going numb. Or we get overcome by criticism or doubt. When we can stay on the wave, really magical things can happen. And the only way we can stay on that wave is when we can cultivate our capacity to witness our experience, to kind of stay present to our experience in a way that we can ride the wave rather than be overcome by it or just escape entirely. So I made a really conscious decision in the process of feeling the vacuum after he was gone of really turning my attention to the waves when they arose, to the best of my ability not to resist them and not to go into the sense, whatever my internal dialogue around that was, this isn't appropriate or this is too much. Or I simply don't want to feel this experience. So whenever I would feel a wave, they're kind of rogue waves, as you know. It's clear sailing, and a rogue wave comes, and suddenly we're on this trajectory of some internal experience that we can name in all the multitude of emotions. But what I found, kind of to my surprise and kind of to my delight, was that the more I would embrace the wave and just ride it, the less and less intense they became. And with that lessening of intensity, there wasn't any lessening in my care or my gratitude or my love for that which I lost. It was actually like a deeper, broader sense of appreciation and gratitude and love. It was such a powerful experience for me. Really, really grateful to have that as a practice. So often when we experience something unpleasant, we turn our attention away from it. We distract ourselves. But part of the practice of Vipassana meditation is actually turning our attention to that. That becomes our practice. The resistance becomes our practice. That which is between us and feeling free becomes our practice. So we explore what it means to allow it, to investigate it, to be intimate with it. And ultimately we begin to disidentify from it somehow. Our identification begins to shift, and we can hold it in a much less personal space, and actually a more compassionate space. So we've talked a lot in this class, and certainly training in meditation and Buddhist psychology and Buddhist philosophy is very much a training of awareness. But we're training ourselves how to pay attention. We're training ourselves how to be intimately present to what's arising, to even know what's arising. But in addition to that, to be aware of our relationship to it, of how we're holding our experience. There was on this retreat, there was someone during one of the interviews who came in. And this is a 15-minute interview, twice a week for those who do a longer retreat. And they had this huge smile on their face. And oftentimes you don't see that on a meditation retreat. And she said, I just realized that my suffering comes from whatever story I'm believing in the moment. And it was just that recognition of when we're caught to ask ourselves, what story am I believing right now? And we begin to see that we're more than our stories, we're more than our thoughts. We begin to see that we're more than the moods and emotions that play through us. And we see that we're even more than this body. There's something beyond this body, because this body is subject to change. And there's something that perhaps doesn't change in this game. So when you think about how your practice of meditation, however long you've practiced, to really sense what has the benefit been for you? What have you noticed? What has shifted in your life through the shift in being able to stay more present to your life rather than reacting to your life? It's one of the wonderful benefits of this practice. And what we really start to see, when we really begin to slow down and actually examine the moment-to-moment experience of reality, is we start to see that everything changes. That anything that's born will die. Anything that comes out of causes and conditions is subject to change. Everything. And then we get to see our relationship to it. And we get to see that where there is resistance, there is some form of stress. There's some form of suffering. And the more we pay attention, the more we realize that the stuff we're kind of hanging on to, well, there's just kind of a little bit of stress, a little bit of suffering. And the stuff we're really hanging on to, there's a lot of stress, a lot of dissatisfaction and suffering. The other thing that we begin to see more and more intimately is the nature of this, what we call ourself. This self that we are holding is also changing. It's also born out of causes and conditions. And we see that that just got a lot of holes in it. Who you were 20 years ago, are you exactly that same person? When I look in the mirror, I can tell you I'm not. We also become much more aware of what's between us and feeling free. Because the more we practice this, we get these moments of insight, moments of spaciousness. And we all have those experiences, whether it be in meditation or not, when the whole, any sense of I and mine isn't there. It might be in a moment of meditation, it might be in a moment of making love, it might be in a moment of being immersed into nature, it might be in a moment of intimate conversation, of playing sports. But that sense of I and mine isn't there. And when I and mine isn't there, what's that? What's that space? We know it. We know it. But it's so hard to name. But that classic story of two little fish swimming down the river out to the ocean. And a big fish is coming in from the ocean, swims by them and says, "Nice water, boys." And one little fish says to the other one, "What the hell is water?" So we get more aware of what's in between us and feeling free, what's between us and feeling happy. We can begin to identify these mind states. Oh, here's ill will, here's judgment, here's blame. Here's fantasy, here's holding on. Here's anxiety, here's worry. Here's grief. Here's not able to feel anything. Here's judgment. Here's doubt. The more we train ourselves to pay attention, the more we begin to recognize, oh, these are the clouds. These are the weather systems. And as soon as we can name them, we reinforce a sense of who we are as the awareness itself. The third thing, I'm sure there are more than three, but I'll just stick to three. The third thing that we begin to recognize from training and awareness is we begin to identify not only the states that are between us and feeling free, but we get to really, through the increased sensitivity that comes out of this, we can begin to evaluate our life and our lifestyle and our practices and determine with greater clarity whether they're wholesome or not. And there's a really powerful aspect of that practice. We become more sensitive. So that which was tolerable before, just it's not quite as tolerable. And there's a sense, kind of almost like an organic process of just shedding skin. And then oftentimes people notice that when they start or they deepen a meditation practice, their friends begin to change. The old activities just don't, they were really fun and not quite, they don't quite do it anymore. By the way, there's such a cool piece from Ken Wilber. When he talks about change, when you're coming to the end of something, whether it be the end of a relationship or end of a job or end of some commitment, there's a tendency for the mind to make something wrong. Either we make ourselves wrong, or we make the other wrong, to kind of justify it in the mind. It's such a natural thing for the human mind to do. This metaphor just worked so well for me. He said, instead of making it wrong, try the analogy of that you've been eating at a buffet table, and you can't eat another bite. You are so delighted to find the buffet table. It fed you for a really long time. You're really excited about it, but you're full. You got to get up and walk around for a while. Isn't that a different way of framing change in your life? It totally works for me. The other thing that comes out of cultivating wisdom, cultivating awareness, is we realize how much we have to let go of in this life. we come to realize is we realize that everything born out of causes and conditions is subject to change. That's everything. That's your body. Everyone you know, everyone you love is going to die in no particular order. Everything you cherish, everything you're holding on to, at some point, is going to dissipate and disappear. And that's kind of a hard truth to take in, but we know it to be true. And what I find so interesting with, I knew ever since I got my puppy that this dog was going to die. And certainly as he was walking like a drunken sailor and deaf and hardly able to see, I knew he was going to die. There was no doubt about it. That didn't make it any easier. And what was really required for me to accompany him and myself through that loss of form into formless was compassion. It was the heart. Was the ability to hold it internally somehow. So I wanted to talk a little bit about this training in the heart. Today as I was driving in, the roads were jammed. Traffic was just terrible, you know. So, you know, have cars kind of slowly go by. And so I just found myself kind of doing this mental game of like, well, would I like to have that car? You know, and then like a car would go by, like, nah, I wouldn't want that car. But you know, try to imagine, you know, sports car. Yeah, well, would I like to have that? And so then I noticed like imagining, because I had a lot of time, I started imagining what would it feel like to be driving that car. You know, so in some cars you're like driving like this. You know, in some cars you're like in a really big Mercedes, it's like you're sitting on a sofa. You know, others, they're more like little sports cars in your back. And it was just kind of fun to sort of imagine. So then I noticed I was like watching the drivers and sort of seeing their posture. And then it just kind of morphed into like imagining what they were feeling. So I wonder what it's like for that person driving that car. And it actually became, and I realized it started becoming a really empathic experience. You know, because I'd look over and there'd be someone who, you know, you just see, it was like they were on fumes, you know, just trying to get home, you know, and then another van would go by and there'd be, you know, some guys smoking and, you know, and drinking Coke, and it was a completely different energy, and it was just a really fun experience to really see how it's our capacity to imagine what another person is feeling is part of the training in the heart practices. To shift out of a sense of self and to open to others and their experience. And what happens is, there's this wonderful thing called mirror neurons. And you ever notice how, like, when a lot of little kids are playing and one kid starts to cry, how other kids start to cry? Or I remember being in kindergarten, one kid throws up. Boom! We feel what other people feel. We take on what other people take on. And it's a very interesting thing to see how the more we slow down, the more sensitive we become to ourselves and to those around us. So the story goes that in the Buddhist tradition, when someone wanted to study with him, he would just send them out into the woods. And you know, if you read the scriptures, you know, you find a tree, sit cross-legged at the tree, bring your attention to the breath, see you in 5 years, you know. So people go out into the woods to do their practice. And there are a lot of creepy, crawly things out there in the woods. And also, at that time, in that culture, and even in the culture now, there's a very strong cultural belief in ghosts. So these poor monks were out there just scared to death. And they came scampering back to the Buddha, and they said, "Give us how do we deal with this? How do we deal with this?" So the Buddha, supposedly, at that time, gave the practice of loving kindness. The word practice, the word is called metta, M-E-T-T-A, and it's a derivative of the word metta, meaning friend. So it's really about befriending yourself and befriending the world. So the monks were instructed to actually offer kindness, offer compassion to all those creepy crawly things out there, to actually offer and project kindness and compassion to all the ghosts out there as well. And what happened was that the monks found over time they were less fearful, and they actually had a much more of a capacity to actually feel they were part of their experience, part of their environment, rather than protecting themselves and holding themselves separate. And it's a very interesting practice to offer someone well who is really scary to you. To actually wish someone well who is a competitor. It kind of blows fuses in the brain when you do that. There's a wonderful story. It's probably an urban myth, but it's a really good one. It's a story a woman tells. She was on a bus, a city bus, and the bus stopped to pick up, it looked like a homeless man. You know, he had a lot of bags. And as he was getting on the bus, you could tell he was kind of disturbed. And he didn't have the right change. He was like fumbling to find the right change. Right? And so the bus driver yelled at him. And then he got really angry, like really angry and really verbal. And this woman said everyone in the bus started clenching inside. You could just feel the tension in the bus. And people were looking to the back of the bus to see if there was a back door so they could get out. And there wasn't in that bus. And so she, too, was feeling all this kind of crackling tension in the air. And then it occurred to her, she just had this thought, she said, no one's praying for him. So she just started praying for him, just wishing him well, wishing him peace, wishing him ease. And so while this was going on, he eventually found the right change, and as he was shuffling to the back of the bus with his bags, as he walked by her, he stopped and he said, thank you, I feel much better now. You never know. There's another story, since I'm on. That's a story. This is a story that Sharon Salzberg tells, and she leads a lot of retreats on metta, on the practice of cultivating loving kindness. She was leading this retreat in New York City. And so she sent people out to do walking meditation in the street and to offer metta to people, just to find someone and offer them, you know, surreptitiously, you know. You're not finding a stranger. So this woman was, there was a subway station right across, a train station right across the street. So she was on the platform. And she found... just saw some guy, kind of an ordinary-looking guy wearing a coat and tie. And as she was doing walking meditation, she was just, like, projecting, you know, may you be happy, may you feel safe from inner and outer harm, may you be free from suffering. And this guy walked over to her, and she was a little startled. And he said, excuse me, I hope you don't think I'm crazy, but something in me just wanted to ask you to pray for me. I'm going through a really hard time right now. We can't measure that. We just can't measure. The heart is referred to in Buddhist practice as the immeasurable state. There are four essential qualities of the heart. There's the immeasurable state of kindness, of compassion, of joy, and of equanimity. Equanimity being your capacity to be with anything. Those states cannot be measured. And we can't measure the impact of them. A practice I do sometimes is referred to as stealth metta. Very much like she was practicing on the train station. So I do that sometimes. Really, it's not that often. But when I think about it, I do it. And I like to do it when I'm doing grocery shopping. Because you just got your cart and you're kind of rolling around and just kind of sending silent messages to people. And it's a really freaky experience. Because, I mean, a lot of people just, you know, they're just doing their day, but people might stop, or sometimes people just sort of like stop and turn and smile. It's such a great exercise. And a really good thing to do in traffic, too, if you have the wherewithal at that time. So it's said that the practice of paying attention cultivates wisdom. And wisdom is the recognition of what is true. And that is the inherent emptiness of this life. That everything that comes into form leaves form at some point. And that quality of emptiness it's an extraordinary insight when we have those experiences. It is feeling the timelessness of this life. Compassion opens us to this embodied experience. It actually opens us to relationship with the world around us. It opens us to recognize that which we think is separate really isn't that separate. As Werner Erhard said, 5 billion people thinking they're unique is not unique. Sri Nisargadatta, who was a kind of this wonderful non-dual teacher from India, he said, "Wisdom tells me I am nothing. Compassion tells me I am everything. And between those two, my life flows." It's such a beautiful statement of what this life can be, of recognizing that every one of us here is going to die. And at the same time, to embrace the aliveness and the vibrancy of this moment, of this life. So what gets in the way of compassion kind of brings us back again to this sense of I and mine. This is my land, it's my idea, it's my stuff, it's my opinion. And perhaps now more than in a long time, we're just seeing how much violence there is in the name of protecting I and mine. The fighting and the fundamentalism and the inflexibility and the politics. It's also interesting to see how much opinions get narrowed in this time. How I notice the websites I go to are pretty much the websites where I agree with everything they're saying. I read this story of a woman who grew up in rural Texas and moved far, far away, and decided maybe she'd friend some of her high school friends, who weren't really friends, but people she went to school with. So she kind of clicked some people as friends, and suddenly there was this barrage of beliefs and a political orientation that was completely different than hers. And she was part of her commentary was how we've kind of created an echo chamber that just mirrors our own opinions back to ourselves. It's such a challenge for us to stay open to what other people are feeling. So when we train our attention to actually tune into what other people are feeling, it's very skillful to start with what's most comfortable. The practice of metta is actually kind of like putting on training wheels. So we're oftentimes encouraged to start with someone or something that's really easy. It's just really easy to send good wishes and to send blessings to. It's always good to start with a pet or a plant or a benefactor, someone who was really kind to you. So I wanted to lead kind of a little two-part reflection on just this sense of reflecting on another's experience. So if you like, you can close your eyes. And as you feel the breath, you might bring into mind someone in your life that's going through a hard time right now. Someone you know who might be struggling in some way. And you might just sense and try to imagine or feel what their experience is like. What do you imagine it feels like for them inside? What do you imagine they're believing about themselves and their life right now? And you might explore, as you reflect and investigate this person struggling in their life right now, of what you feel on the inside. Can you locate any sensations or feelings on the inside? And you might, in your own way, just send them just a sense of presence. Nothing to fix, but simply to be with it. You might reflect on perhaps some of the following words, just offering them internally with the quality of feeling inside. May you feel safe. May you know peace. May you be free from suffering. And then letting this sort of fall away with the breath. We'll explore kind of a little second reflection. Bringing into mind someone that you might be feeling some conflict with. There might be a little disagreement or power struggle or in some way feeling separate from another. And what do you imagine it's like from their perspective? What are their fears? Can you get a sense of what they're most needing right now in order to feel more whole? Deepening the breath and letting this fall away. And if you like, you can open the eyes or remain with the eyes closed. A lot can be learned when we can bring ourselves to another's experience, and particularly with whom we have conflict. When we can begin to sense what the other person's needing, it can oftentimes provide some new insights and new possibilities. There's a Dale Carnegie, way back when, said that everyone is listening to the same radio station, WIFM, which stands for What's in It for Me. And he had this beautiful articulation of how to communicate, which is to really understand what is the other person needing, to really embrace the fact that they are listening from a place of what's in it for me. And when you can speak into that, you can establish a very powerful connection. It's actually can be a very powerful heart connection. So the practice of cultivating kindness has been described as widening ripples. It's oftentimes helpful to start with something that's easy, something that you feel a positive connection to. Just to kind of gets the juices flowing a little bit. In one retreat, there is one older man, this was a number of years ago, who was really struggling in this retreat. And during the compassion practices, just really having a hard time. And he sat with one of the teachers and they talked about where he could start. And he had been divorced and he was, his children weren't talking to him, he was retired and really not happy. And so he kept saying, well, what's a relationship you feel good about? And he couldn't come up with one. And after about 45 minutes, they got to a place where when he was a kid, there was the dog in the neighborhood that he kind of liked. And that's where he started. That's where he started. Just thinking about that dog that he kind of liked. And just looking for what that felt like inside. And the basic rule is, where the attention goes, the energy flows. As you start focusing on compassion and kindness, more and more energy will move in that direction. Of course, the energy that moves in that direction will also bring up everything that isn't kindness and compassion as well. For the purpose of healing. Why is there that great statement from Harville Hendricks, who said that romantic love is the anesthesia that brings two incompatible people together for the purpose of healing. So we're drawn to that which sparks us to greater aliveness. So we begin with something that's easy, and then we turn our attention to ourselves. That when our heart is at peace, when our compassion is flowing, only then can we really offer it out to others. On the plane, they always tell you, put the air mask on yourself before your child. That you have to be able to cultivate this from the inside in order to be able to offer it out. And that's where so many of us get stuck. Because we're so tripped up by this ruthless inner critic, which is just sort of a part of this human experience. To really take time to reflect on self-compassion is, it's real work. And then as we begin to build a sense of well-being inside, it can actually become much easier to offer it out. The analogy, which I probably overuse, is that the phrase of my cup runneth over. You know, when you've got so much energy, you're feeling so good, you can't contain it. starting spontaneous conversations with the checkout person, waving someone across the intersection. You can't contain it. And that's why when people talk about meditation and yoga being self-indulgent, I couldn't agree more. It's really your job to get your cup overflowing. Otherwise, your effectiveness in the world isn't what it could be. So self-indulgence has a really healthy quality to it if it cultivates a more wholesome state where you simply feel your heart giving because it hurts not to give. That takes some work. But then as we offer it outward, it begins with ourself, and then it begins, the next is our inner circle, our family, our most loved ones. If we can create peace internally, we can create peace in the home. If we can create peace in the home, we can radiate out to our community. And from the community out to the greater community and out to the world. Where we tend to overlook is beginning with ourselves. I'm going to stop myself here. And just wondering if there are any comments or questions about the practice of metta or anything about your practice, anything at all. Yeah.
I have two questions, and I can't decide which one I care more about. So I'll start with this one. When we were during the meditation, and you said close to the end, you said, now see what it would be like if you didn't have any particular technique you were using. And I panicked because I was like, okay, I'm pausing on the in-breath and I'm focusing on the out-breath and my hands are up, my heart is open, thank God I'm finally doing this. And then he said, don't do any of that. And I'm like, now what? So I really didn't know what to do at that point.
No, I noticed you were right on the verge of spontaneous combustion.
Is that what could happen?
All that's left are your earrings. So what did happen for you when you abandoned all technique?
I didn't know what to do. I couldn't. I kept going out. Out. I was like, okay, don't say out, but then what do I do? It was really stayed kind of like that.
Yeah. It's a really wild practice. It's the practice of non-manipulation. And what's very interesting is, there's a little bit of my yoga background in here, but one way to look at it is three stages of meditation. From yoga philosophy is described as dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. Dharana is concentration. So you start with concentration to gather yourself in one place. And concentration doesn't have a lot of investigation. Either you feel the breath or you don't feel the breath. Mind wanders, you bring it back. Mind wanders, you bring it back. Concentration techniques, they calm the mind. They can create a sense of tranquility. So that's concentration, or shamatha. And then there's vipassana, which is sort of the investigation. And you notice how when you start with concentration, at some point, sometimes, you just sort of feel your awareness kind of widen a little bit and broaden, and then you become aware of flow. You become aware of how everything is changing. Oh, this sound was there, and now it's gone. Someone just moved behind me. I heard their chair creak. Now it's not happening. Oh, a whole story about what I'm going to get for dinner just went through and now it's gone. But you still have a quality, you're still connected to the moment, but you're also aware of what's changing. And that's a shift in brainwaves. But it's also in the second stage. And the Tibetans describe it as a waterfall, like you're standing under a waterfall. Of sensation, sound, mood, feeling, states, you know, constantly changing. And then the third stage is referred to as samadhi. From the yoga tradition, it's different in the Buddhist tradition, but samadhi is the capacity to just be. To to just be in your experience without attempting to control or manipulate whatsoever. And it's more effective when you have a sense of presence. You know, like when you're aware of the tree branch, then you can widen your awareness to be aware of the clouds that are going by. It's sort of like, that's the approach I find to be very helpful. Which is why, like, you know, holding the breath, inhaling, relaxing on the exhale, that's a very willful practice. And then the slow motion movement of the hands. Did you find the slow motion movement of the hands, was that concentrating? Mm-hmm. Or like maybe a, not necessarily, but maybe a feeling of absorption? Were you just like aware of that sense of flow? I'd find those particular techniques, particularly after a long day when your mind is scattered, you've been out there, working hard, it just grabs your attention and really helps you to be here. So it can be an organic process, but it can also be a really kind of disarming practice to do too. There's a wonderful practice, which is to close your eyes and not pay attention. You can't do it. Yes?
Recognizing, and correct me if I'm wrong, but recognizing that the practice is not goal-oriented, correct? But if we use maybe a word like intention, is the intent of the practice to change our relationship to conflict, or to try to use the practice to, I guess in our own mind, change the conflict?
Wow, what a great question. What a great question. The answer is yes. Next? No, seriously. There are really two answers. One is our intention is to be fully present to what is. Our intention is to investigate the nature of reality. And so that is to not, whatever, ultimately, to not resist what arises, to not resist what goes away. So when unpleasant arises, either physical sensation, an emotional experience, unpleasant thoughts or beliefs, the practice is to be with them as they arise. That's the ultimate practice. Inevitably, I don't know about you, but I slip into a sense of, I want to feel better. And part of the reason why I'm meditating is, I want to be clearer in my mind, I want to be more empathic, I want to be more focused, I want to know what the most important thing is, and I want to be able to move through the stuff that's in my way. So there is an element of the practice that kind of comes up like, okay, how do I fix this? And it can be a very powerful way of fixing things. You know, it can be a very, meditation and the investigative element of Vipassana is an incredibly powerful way to untie the knots that bind you. To really examine, you know, well, so what do I feel inside when I feel this sense of resentment of what's happening at work? Can I be with it? What story am I believing? Is that belief true? Who am I without that belief? We can do some serious cleansing and clearing with this practice. And it can become a real catch as well. I think ultimately what we come back to is, I mentioned one thing in the instruction. It's a very cool pointing out instruction. Is at any time in your practice to ask yourself, what's the attitude in my mind right now? Am I judging something and trying to push it away? Is there something I'm experiencing that's really cool that I want to hold on to? As soon as we notice how we're holding it, then we realize there's a third option, which is to let it be, you know, to really be with it. Does that help at all?
Yes, and no.
Good one.
That's great. Yes.
I wanted to asking more about who you came out here, the girl who was smiling and was saying, I'm teaching myself the story and believing it. You can say a little bit more about that, and how do you catch yourself creating the story and believing it?
Yeah, it's a great one. We can investigate our experience on many levels. The first foundation investigation is the direct experience of it inside. You know, so, you know, if you are, you find yourself feeling jealous of someone else, to investigate, okay, so when I'm experiencing that, where do I feel it? Can I locate that feeling? Oh, yeah, there's this tightening around my heart, and my throat is tight, and so you really feel where it kind of lives in your nervous system. And then you examine, can I allow that? Can I be with that? Can I hold this with a sense of loving presence? And we can sort of shift, experience some very profound shifts on that level. And that's kind of the primary instruction, is bring it into the immediacy of here and now. Now, don't indulge into thought, because when we try and think our way out of solutions, it's oftentimes like trying to put out a fire with gasoline, you know. But there is a very powerful level of investigation on the level of thought. And that is when you find yourself really caught, you know, physical pain, emotional turmoil, whatever it may be, to really ask yourself, what story am I believing right now? What's the core belief right now? And it takes some time to kind of drill down to what that is. But then you can actually investigate that thought. Primarily, again, this is Byron Katie, a wonderful teacher, articulates this so beautifully. Just a few questions. What am I believing? Is it true? The next question is it really true? Because you really got to nail yourself to the wall on that. Do I absolutely know beyond a shadow of a doubt that what I'm believing is true? And then to really investigate, so when I do believe it, what's my experience? And to really get to know where it lives inside, where it lives in your nervous system. That could be a very powerful investigation. And then the kicker question. Who am I without that belief? That's where we can just sometimes get a taste of who we are without the software running us. Thanks. So our time has flown. Thank you so much. It was great to be with you. We'll close with a short meditation. Just a couple quick announcements. I'm leading a day-long retreat this Saturday. It's called a Meditative Journey. It's movement, meditation, and deep relaxation. And it's really exploring coming to the practice of Vipassana through the lens of relaxation. It's been said that transformation is really only possible through deep relaxation. So it's a really cool day. We do movement, deep relaxation, sitting meditation. We do two main rounds, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, and other supportive practices. We're in silence for most of the day. If you'd like to be on the mailing list, you can sign up out there. Thank you, as always, for your donations and support. They support St. Mark's and the Insight Meditation Community of Washington and me. So if you like, you can close your eyes. And you might bring your attention into your breathing, just to notice where you feel the breath most predominant. And you might very gently, as you feel the breath, just reflect on these qualities of the heart. Just sensing your infinite capacity for kindness. to yourself and to others. Your infinite capacity for love for yourself and for others. Your capacity for joy for yourself and for others. And your capacity for equanimity. Your capacity to be with whatever arises. And gently, as you're ready, you can deepen the breath. And as you're ready, letting the eyes open. Namaste.
Namaste.
If you'd like, you could offer a namaste to the person on your right and left. Thank you so much for coming. We're going to put chairs to the back of the room and... have a wonderful week.